Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee Podcast. I'm Jordan Edwards, Communications Associate at the BJC. Today we're going to review the top religious liberty stories of the year. My guest is Don Bird, who blogs for the BJC. He's joining me live via Skype from his home in Nashville, Tennessee. You can read Don's stories on the BJC website at bjconline.org/blog. How are you, Don?
I'm doing great, Jordan. How are you?
Good, good. We're going to begin with the statement that Donald Trump made earlier this week when he declared that Muslims in general, all Muslims, shouldn't be allowed, should be barred from entering the U.S. On a temporary basis till he said that, till our representatives figure out what's going on, which is very un-American. And the BJC responded swiftly with a statement from Executive Director Brent Walker. Brent said in his statement, "Donald Trump's proposal to ban Muslims from entering the U.S. is un-American, unworkable, counterproductive, and embarrassing. It's no more than disgusting demagoguery, exploiting popular fear and fanning pervasive anti-Muslim bigotry for political gain. Americans deserve better than this from those who seek to lead." Now, we won't get into the constitutionality of barring an entire religion from entering the country, but Don, what was your reaction to this statement?
Well, I think it's shock. I'm still a little bit in shock. I mean, the whole idea of, and we've heard this kind of sentiment from other candidates as well, this sort of rising anti-Muslim rhetoric that seems to be, you know, gaining traction, unfortunately, and growing in intensity. I just have to sort of step back and I'm amazed that this kind of statement can even be made by a person who wants to lead the country. You know, it started earlier in the year with, I believe, Ben Carson, who began with the idea that Muslims weren't fit to run for president, in his view, because Islam was, according to him, not consistent with the U.S. Constitution, which is, of course, outrageous and directly contradicts what the Constitution says about no religious test for office. We had other candidates later who chimed in and saying that refugees from Syria should only be allowed in if they're Christians, however it is we would determine that, and which is, of course, another sort of outrageous step. And now Trump talking about Muslim databases and closing the borders. It's really ramping it up. And, I was thinking, Jordan, that in normal, like, presidential election time, you might sort of brush this off as a bunch of, you know, campaign talk designed to appeal to the extreme base of your party. But I think this has serious ramifications. You know, there's millions of Muslim Americans who live among us as coworkers, neighbors, friends, and I'm sure that this whole discussion makes them uneasy.
And thousands in our military too.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, good point. And so, it's dangerous. This kind of talk is dangerous.
Speaking of the elections, this will be a big year for you as a blogger in regards to the election season coming up in 2016. What kind of things are you looking forward to in regards to religious liberty issues when it comes to election season?
Well, when religious liberty issues come up in election season, it's usually not good news. It's usually because of someone fanning flames of fear or divisiveness as a political tactic. At least that's what we've seen so far. So in a sense, I'm not looking forward to it.
There's always something to write about, though.
That's true. Yeah, I'm unfortunately anticipating plenty of material. We have a whole year to go in the election, and the good news, such that there is good news, is that even after Trump's statement, you know, many other candidates, every other candidate, so far as I know, announced some level of disagreement with his proposal. As long as we have people pushing back against that, then the conversation in the campaign might still be positive. And if not, then it's up to advocates to make their voice heard.
We got a little bit ahead of ourselves, Don. We uh, we want to talk about the year in review, as well as what's coming up. One of the biggest stories this year in religious liberty was, of course, the Obergefell decision that allowed same-sex marriage across the land. And you can't mention the Obergefell decision without mentioning Kim Davis's refusal as Rowan County, Kentucky clerk to sign marriage licenses. Now, Holly Holman, our general counsel to BJC, wrote a column a couple months ago about this. What was your take on the situation?
When I think about the Kim Davis story, I kind of, if you look at it in a big picture, it was a small story in Kentucky maybe, but it was emblematic of a broader struggle that is going on across the country as far as how to balance certain religious liberties with other civil rights. And so I guess my reaction is that distinguishing feature of Kim Davis' story is that she's an elected official and has certain obligations as an elected official to treat all of her constituents equally, lawfully, without discrimination. And so I think many advocates kind of picked up on her story as if it was the same as some other levels of objection, when it's really kind of a different animal to have government officials claiming that they don't have to do their job duties because of religious liberty concerns. Now, it looks like Kentucky may try to take some steps to accommodate her by changing the way that they think about the marriage license issuance. And that may be an appropriate step for any state dealing with this, instead of trying to have that kind of conflict, just try to rethink the way that we issue marriage licenses in the first place.
And obviously churches, as you know, as private churches, as nonprofits, as their own entities, can choose not to perform gay marriages in their churches. But obviously, when you step into a city hall situation, it's a different thing.
Of course. And I think that was one of the most troubling things about that story, is that the Kim Davis story got kind of lumped in with other objectors, whether it's the bakers and the florists who don't want to participate in weddings, or it's clergy who don't want to perform ceremonies. And of course, the First Amendment provides strong protection for clergy not to perform wedding ceremonies that violate their religious beliefs. But unfortunately, some of these some of these objectors have kind of been lumped together in the national conversation and have made people probably more fearful about the religious liberty impact of the Obergefell decision than they necessarily need to be.
It was a strange time. You know, it's funny to think about, because you don't really hear, it's kind of quieted down, but for, you know, a couple months there, it dominated the news, not just religion news, but the mainstream media.
Well, I suppose we at least have Donald Trump to thank for that.
Yeah. One of the things that that you do enjoy writing about a lot is court cases and the Supreme Court. The BJC signed on to a pair of briefs. One was in the case of Holt v. Hobbs, where a Muslim prisoner won the right to wear a beard for religious purposes in prison. And this was a unanimous decision on the Supreme Court's part. Don, why was this case such a slam dunk in favor of the prisoner's right to wear a religiously mandated beard?
Well, I think it's because the state's argument was basically that they should be given deference without really any question. Fortunately, the court looked at that and said, you know, we give deference to prison officials, of course, because they have to maintain security in a difficult environment and they know best how to do that. But that doesn't mean that we just take their word for it in all cases, or that the deference is without question. So I think that the court looked at the state's argument and found that it didn't have very, very much meat to it. So they just were sort of saying, trust us that this is necessary for security, but the more questions you asked, the less necessary it seemed. I mean, he was asking for the right to wear a half-inch beard. And I think as the court sort of poked fun at, you know, it's hard to hide a revolver in your half-inch beard.
Yeah, very true. And a lot of other states already allow this. So, you know.
Exactly.
The other case that the BJC was involved with earlier this year was the case of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or EEOC, versus Abercrombie and Fitch. This case involved a young woman who was not hired at an Abercrombie kids store because of her hijab, her headscarf. And again, the court ruled overwhelmingly in her favor. So again, I pose this question to you, Don. Why was this case such an easy case for the justices to decide?
Well, I think the court said that the law clearly says, the Civil Rights Act clearly says, that you can't discriminate because of religion. In this case, the facts sort of showed that the Abercrombie interviewers had reason to believe that she wore her headscarf because she was Muslim, and they denied her application because of the headscarf. It was pretty clear cut from that point of view. Now, the court could have weakened the law there. They could have said, which is what Abercrombie was asking them to do, the court could have said that it was the responsibility of the applicant to sort of raise this issue or make sure that they knew that she had this religious need. And the court said, well, you had enough reason to know, and they certainly suspected that it was they believed it was a religious headscarf. And so the court said that's enough, and which is good news, because those protections are important. We don't want to make applicants for a job have to choose between a livelihood and their faith. And so the court strongly supported that principle.
What's coming up after the new year in terms of religious liberty cases?
Well, just recently, in the last month, I suppose, the Supreme Court announced that they are going to hear another case regarding the contraception mandate in the Affordable Care Act. This case involves religious organizations. It's a set of cases, really, religious organizations that are objecting to the government's process for them opting out of the mandate. And so, we don't know exactly what the court's focus will be. We'll have to find out about that next year. But it's just another instance of the court looking at this Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And it'll be interesting to see where they go.
You created a RFRA tracker of Religious Freedom Restoration Acts across the country. Go to bjconline.org/RFRA. Where does that stand? Are states continuing to adjust their state RFRAs and draft new ones? Or where are we at on that front?
Well, we have a few that are, there's rumblings that they're staying alive. In Georgia, the state RFRA proposal that already passed the Senate, which the state Senate, and is in the state House, some lawmakers there are hoping to revive it in January. And it will be interesting to see how many states kind of bring theirs back up. In 2015, we only had two states that passed RFRA laws, and the news and coverage about that and the backlash in some cases was so intense that I think it kind of scared away some other states from doing that. So I'm not sure what that will be like this year, but that's another thing that will be kind of fun to watch, to see which states decide to either revamp their RFRAs or develop new ones.
One of the other big issues is school vouchers. There's a few of these cases floating around. So Don, can you tell us where we've been in school vouchers cases and where they're heading in the next year?
Well, this year we got a couple of important school voucher decisions from state Supreme Courts. In Colorado, the state Supreme Court ruled unconstitutional a voucher system that was in, I believe, Douglas County. And those are problematic. School vouchers are, because they send public money to religious schools. And most of the private schools that received vouchers in that program were religious schools. And so in Colorado, the state constitution provides that no public monies should be used for church or sectarian schools. And so the court looked at it and said plainly that the state constitution didn't allow it. Many state constitutions have provisions like that prohibit aid to religion. And in Colorado, the court kind of drew a pretty strong line there. And they have a very strong provision. The BJC did join a brief urging the court to strike down the program for that reason. And in North Carolina, a voucher program was allowed to continue despite a similar argument, though the law there is a little bit different and the program there is a little bit different. So the circumstances there were not the same. The one that I'm really looking forward to hearing more about next year is in Nevada. where a voucher program, which is really sweeping, I mean, this program is a statewide program. Everyone is allowed to participate in sending their children to private schools using taxpayer money. And their constitution also has this no aid to religion provision. So a lawsuit has been filed already, and it'll be interesting to see where the state courts go with that question. And so, you know, states are allowed to provide stronger protections than the federal constitution requires. And so, and that's certainly what Colorado did. The whole idea of sending taxpayer money to religious education is problematic.
So Don, that's a good review of religious liberty stories across the country. It was also a big year for the BJC in terms of new programs and new endeavors. We launched the BJC Fellows program earlier this year, where 10 people from across the country ventured to Colonial Williamsburg to learn more about religious liberty from BJC staff and from experts. We also started a new lecture series. We went out to Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, California, where we had these lectures on social justice and religious liberty with Judge Wendell Griffin, and those were great. We've also had some sad times here at the BJC. We lost a board member, a longtime board member, Steve Case, earlier this year. And we also, of course, lost former BJC executive director James Dunn, who passed away at the age of 83. Don, what do you think about when you think about James Dunn? What's his legacy to you?
Well, for me, James' legacy was, of course, like everyone who talks about James, it's his passion, his level of commitment, and his vigor about these issues of religious liberty. But it's also the way that he continually tied the question of religious liberty to the question, to the issue of personal faith and personal religious experience and personal religious commitment. You know, this focus that he had on soul freedom, soul liberty, and the idea that we have to prevent government discrimination on the basis of religion, not just because it's unfair to those who discriminates against, but because it harms our own ability to choose freely and to have our own authentic religious experience. So I'll always remember James for, of course, his witticisms and his passion, but also just this idea that I try to keep coming back to as I cover religious liberty, that it's about, ultimately, it's about a personal freedom of conscience that's essential to real, true faith.
And he's meant a lot to your family, to the Byrd family. Your brother Kenny worked here and interned here, and
That's how I met James the first time was through Kenny. And I think he gave me a big old bear hug the first time I met him.
Yeah. He never met a stranger.
No,
never met a stranger. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me, Don. We look forward to your stories in the new year, and have a good holiday season.
Thanks very much. And of course, read the whole Best of 2015 stories at the blog.
Thank you for listening to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. For more podcasts, visit our website at bjconline.org/podcasts or subscribe to our iTunes channel. And since this is the very last podcast of 2015, have a good holiday season and have a happy new year.